nanohub.org.
Online simulation and more for nanotechnology.
Okay, so why don't we start? So, well, it's a pleasure to host our visitor today, Abram Falk. He is currently with the University of Chicago, working as a postdoc with David Absalom. So he moved from UC Santa Barbara to Chicago together with his advisor or collaborator at this stage, I guess. Abram's PhD is from Harvard, and he actually did what I like most, kind of collaborative work, which is not that common in many top schools. They broke the rules between two different empires, one of that by Tom Fran Clark in chemistry department, another one by led by Misha Lukin, and so they did some nice collaborative work at the time on using these plasmonic nanowires and quantum dots for photonic applications. And now he's working on all type of these color sensors and solids for quantum photonics application. And Abram is a candidate for faculty position in quantum photonics. So please join me in welcoming Abram.
Thanks a lot, Vlad, and thanks to everybody for showing up this morning. I'm going to be talking about color centers and wide gap semiconductors for quantum information and nanoscale sensing applications. So normally when you think about controlling quantum states, you often think about very low temperatures, very controlled environments to mitigate decoherence, often elaborate traps. And what's special about color centers is that they have, they bring single electron quantum states that can be very readily controlled without any of those things, a very robust systems against decoherence. So if you have just a crystal, this is diamond shown here, and you think of the band gap of a semiconductor in analogy with a vacuum because there's no allowed states in the system, and you create a defect. And this can be as simple as just removing an atom where there otherwise would be one. Those electron bonds, which used to bond to that atom, reorganize into a atom-like state. And in a wide-gap semiconductor, these new electronic states are often deep in the band gap and highly localized. And they're very analogous to an atom trapped in vacuum. They can have sharp optical and spin transitions. And the spins in these defects can actually be so well localized and so well confined that actually they're extremely robust against decoherence. And you can have room temperature quantum coherence in these systems. Yeah.
To remove atom, are these levels most likely to be mid-gap or they can be anywhere?
It depends on the band alignment of the semiconductor, but in a lot of wide band gap semiconductors, they'll be mid-level. Yeah. A special thing about certain ones of certain defects is that these optical and spin transitions are not independent. They're related, and there becomes a mechanism for actually just reading out the spin of single defects using light. And I'll be talking about that shortly. So the format of my talk is I'm going to talk about why wide-gap semiconductors are ideal for this type of physics, and then I'll introduce the prototypical optically addressable spin based on a defect, which is the nitrogen vacancy center in diamond. I'll show an experiment using NV centers in diamond, and then I'll focus on my postdoctoral work has been to replicate NV center physics and silicon carbide, which is a very industrially important material and brings a lot of new possibilities, among them being new ways of controlling electron spins using electric fields and strain. And I'll end with an outlook. So before getting to wide gap defects, I just want to introduce wide gap semiconductors, because it's a really exciting time for wide gap semiconductors in industry. And actually, the industrial applications have really been driven by getting rid of defects. So prior to this physics, people have been trying to understand defects in wide gap semiconductors using electron paramagnetic resonance for many years, but really just so you could see what they are and then get rid of them. I think pretty much everyone's probably familiar with solid state lighting because it's a huge market. Replacing both incandescent and fluorescent lights with LEDs is happening extremely rapidly. Power electronics is much more behind the scenes, but it's actually been a revolution in power electronics based on wide gap semiconductors. Silicon carbide and gallium nitride are replacing silicon for a lot of applications. And this market is going to be a $1 billion market in the next few years. These wide-gap power electronics are being used in applications like high-speed rail, inverters for photovoltaics, even power transmission. And diamond is not really industrially used much as a semiconductor, but I just put a few different semiconductors here in their band gap so you can see where things stack up relative to each other. You know, the wide-gap band gap usually means about, you know, 3 to 5 electron volts. But back to defects. Diamond and silicon carbide are what I'm going to focus on in this talk. And the diamond nitrogen vacancy center is a very special center, as I will be talking about shortly. So what it is it's a substitutional nitrogen atom in the diamond lattice, so a nitrogen atom where the carbon should be next to a vacancy, which is a missing carbon atom. And how do you get these next to each other? Well, if you just anneal diamond, nitrogens stay put, but the vacancies move around, and then they often find the nitrogen atom because when they're next to each other, there's one fewer dangling bonds. The localized electronic state that's bound to the nitrogen vacancy center, or NV center, as I'll be calling it, it has a paramagnetic ground state with spin 1, and I'll talk about more why that is. I'll explain why that is later, but for now, just accept that as a fact. And because it has a paramagnetic ground state, it has a potential to be used as a single spin memory. And in particular, a potential to be used as a single spin memory for quantum memory as well. So there's a spin qubit potential. Now if you compare the localization of electrons to the NV center, it's really on to other artificial atoms like gate-defined gallium arsenide quantum dots or colloidal quantum dots or even impurities in silicon, which is a narrow gap semiconductor. They're much more localized on the single nanometer scale as opposed to the tens or few nanometer scale. And partly as a result of this, the high confinement allows these spin readout and spin memory to operate at elevated temperatures, at room temperature in particular. With spin coherence times in NV centers in diamond ranging from about 10 microseconds to 2 milliseconds, depending on the purity of the diamond. And just for something to compare these times to, essentially the fastest speed that you can have a spin operation on in diamond is about 1 gigahertz. So there's up to about 1 million operations per coherence time in these centers. Coherence time, this is standard NMR terminology. I'll be, presenting things on a block sphere in this talk. So if you have a superposition of a spin up electron and a spin down electron, that's represented by an equatorial vector on the block sphere. And T2 star is the inhomogeneous decoherence time. So essentially, how many times can the superposition process in a laboratory setting before it undergoes decoherence, and then T2 is the homogeneous coherence time if you have a perfectly homogeneous magnetic field or if you apply a Hahn echo sequence, just like in NMR. And coherence time is really important for all applications of paramagnetic color centers. As far as quantum information is concerned, the goal here is to build up networks of spin qubits, and the spin qubits need to interact with each other more strongly than they do with the environment. So the longer you have, in terms of coherence, the less strong interaction you need. Creating these networks of spin qubits is aimed at quantum computing applications, and also in the more near term, quantum communication. And the other, you know, big field of applications other than quantum information, because these defects localize electrons so well, is nanoscale sensing. So the spins in these defects are sensitive to their external environments, like magnetic fields through the Zeeman effect or electric fields through the Stark effect. And so you, by using these defects as nanoscale probes of their surroundings, you have an extraordinary sensitivity and resolution. And just like with quantum information, sensing is also very dependent on coherence time. In frequency domain, essentially the sharpness of the spin transition is 1 over T2. So the longer coherence time you have, the more sensitivity you have. Here's a demonstration here recently from Harvard where they sensed one single electron spin with an NV center in diamond. And all of this was at ambient conditions. Okay, and interestingly enough, a lot of the properties that make wide-gap semiconductors ideal for power electronics also make them ideal for quantum information. Strong crystal bonds lead to both a high band gap and stiff crystal. And as far as power electronics go, high band gap contributes towards high breakdown strength, which allows high electric fields to be applied in the semiconductor, which can accelerate electrons fast. And that leads to high frequency electronics. And also, as you can imagine, especially for power transmission applications and like that, it's really important for the semiconductor to dissipate heat well. And that's aided by the stiff crystal. As far as spin qubits are concerned, the high band gap aids in the electronic isolation of the deep level defects from other things going on in the semiconductor, and aids in coherence. And it allows optical and infrared transitions to happen for these defects all within the band gaps, which aids in optical addressability. And then finally, the stiff crystal contributes towards room temperature quantum coherence, because for stiff crystal translates to high Debye temperature, which means for a given temperature, you have a lower phonon occupation number, fewer phonons to cause decoherence at elevated temperatures. And material purification has been really important for all of these applications. It contributes towards high thermal conductance, high mobility, and long spin coherence times. Okay, so I'll go into some more detail about how the NV center in diamond works and how it has optical addressability. So as I mentioned, it's a spin one ground state, that the NV center in diamond. And there is a zero field splitting arising from the crystal field. So what this means is that it's a spin, there's M sub s equals plus one minus one and zero spin sublevels in the ground state. But the M sub s equals plus and minus one levels are split off from the M sub s equals zero levels, even in zero magnetic field. That's just depicted here. And in the Hamiltonian, that's often represented by a so-called D term. Sigma here is the Pauli matrix. It allows spin resonance using microwaves to happen even without an external magnetic field. Now, there's an optical transition between the ground state and the excited state. And this is a spin-conserving optical transition. So if you say have the defects starting out in the M sub s equals zero state, you excite it up, and then it relaxes down by emitting a red photon. It's still going to be in the M sub s equals zero state, and vice versa, and also for any spin sublevel state. But the key to the optically addressable magnetic resonance in reading out the spin is that there's also another pathway for decay when the defect is in the excited state, going through an inter-system crossing. And this is not spin-conserving, and also the different spin sublevels couple differently to this inter-system crossing. And in particular, the M sub s equals plus one and minus one levels couple more strongly to the inter-system crossing. This is a non-radiative pathway, so what that means is the M sub s equals plus one and minus one spin sublevels appear darker in fluorescence, about 30% darker for the NV center in diamond. So what that means is you can see the spin of a defect just by looking at its fluorescence. And in particular, if you compare the sensitivity of reading out the spin this way to conventional electron paramagnetic resonance, where you're looking at the absorption of microwaves by an emitter, you have an extraordinarily higher sensitivity. Single spin sensitivity is very readily achieved with NV centers in diamond. The other nice thing about this optical cycle is when you go through it multiple times, because the M sub s equals plus one and minus one levels couple more strongly and to the inner system crossing and have a higher chance of having their spin flipped, eventually the spin gets polarized nearly completely in the M sub s equals zero state. So even though, 3 gigahertz is about 100 millikelvin, so you have basically no difference in populations if you just had a Boltzmann distribution. But just by shining light on these defects at room temperature, you can almost completely polarize the spin. Okay, here's an animation of the spin being polarized by shining light on it. Okay, so how do we do these measurements in practice? They can be done either at room temperature or for certain things, cold temperature. Here's a picture of my setup. Here's a little copper rod where a diamond sits right there. A green laser that we shine in to excite the centers, and then we collect the red fluorescence coming out of them. And a magnet we can pull in and out to control the Zeeman effect. Now, if we zoom in to this copper finger, you can see a little diamond here, and you can see microwave lines coming to it for applying microwave fields for optically detected magnetic resonance. Then if we zoom in even more, we can see that there's a little antenna pattern here on the diamond chip. This is to have, strong microwave fields for fast spin rotations. Now, if we take a green laser, focus it to a spot, and scan around the sample, we get this image here. This photoluminescence image. And you can see these little centers here. And each one of these turns out to be single NV centers in diamond. And you can verify that they're single centers by looking at the photon statistics coming out of them. By pulsing the light on and off and also pulsing a microwave field with increasingly strong strength, we can drive Rabi oscillations. So here, basically, the spin is being rotated from the M sub s equals zero state to, in this case, M sub s equals plus one, zero, plus one, zero, plus one. So this is essentially how we do the experiments in very simplified terms. When I talked about the optical cycle, I represented it as a single optical transition. But in reality, that's an oversimplification because there's also a very strong phonon sideband in this material. So what really happens, and this phonon sideband is what allows us to use green light to excite the defects and read out the photoluminescence in the red. It creates an offset between the absorption and the photoluminescence band because essentially starting from the ground state, a defect can be excited to a phonon state in the excited state, then very quickly relaxed down to a metastable excited state, and then again decay into a phonon state and then relaxation to the true ground state. So now coming to the first experiment that I'll show here, one just sort of fundamental question about this optical cycle that we had is, if you create a spin superposition in the ground state and excite it to the optically excited state and have the state undergo this phonon relaxation, is quantum coherence preserved? In other words, if we create a spin state in the ground state and do this optical excitation phonon relaxation process, is the spin state now a superposition or is it a mixed state? Yes.
So what do you mean by phonons? Is that the phonons of the diamond or
yes.
The vibration?
Yeah, that's
so
right.
How the vibrations of this defect state is coupled to the phonons of the diamond?
Well, it's the it's sort of like a molecule undergoing a Raman process. You know, the surrounding atoms vibrate.
But I guess the phonons of the diamonds are broad, kind of extended state. Somehow you need to couple from the localized vibration.
Well, there's also optical phonons, which are much smaller wavelengths.
Okay.
And those are the ones that are principally involved.
I had a question too. Does this graph mean that you really detect fluorescence at a different magnetic field? So you do an excitation in the green at one field and then you quickly switch the field for the readout?
No, it's not a different magnetic field. It's a different wavelength range. So
this is a magnetic field axis. That's not
relevant. Oh, yes. I think that was probably confusingly drawn. These are all happening at the same magnetic field. I'm just superimposed two things on top of each other. It shouldn't be related. Okay, so the question, right, that I want to answer is, you create a superposition in the ground state, excite it, phonon relaxation, is it a superposition or a mixed state? And the way we answer this question is by taking advantage of the fact that we can control spin resonance both in the ground state and through a different color of microwaves, spin resonance in the spin one excited state. So diagrammatically, what's happening here is we initialize the spin, in the M sub s equals zero state, then apply a so-called pi over two pulse to create a spin superposition, which I represent as a horizontal spin vector, then a very fast optical pulse to take the NV center to the optically excited state. And then here the question is now, is this a superposition or a mixed state? And the way we find out is by doing a fast RF pulse in the excited state. And if it's a mixed state, we won't be able to rotate the spin, and if it's a superposition, we will. And the reason why this experiment is somewhat challenging is, first of all, it requires two colors of microwaves to be phase-locked with each other. This excited state pulse has to be very fast because the optical lifetime of the NV center is only about 10 nanoseconds, 10 to 20 nanoseconds. And then the phase of this microwave has to be precisely locked with the timing of this optical pulse. But essentially, if you look at the final spin projection after all of these things, which is just simple fluorescence, you can see very strong fringes, which indicates that, in fact, the spin superposition is very well conserved. In fact, if you view it as a quantum process, the quantum process fidelity is at least 95%. This not only shows that this spin coherence is preserved during optical excitation of NV centers, but it shows that the excited state is a important resource for quantum control. Subsequent experiments, people have shown that you can use the excited state of NV centers in diamond and spin resonance there to couple the spin of electrons in NV centers to the nuclear spins of the nitrogen forming the NV center. Yep.
Single unit center beta or single center?
This is single centers.
That decay of like 5 nanoseconds, what time?
What sets that time scale? Two factors. One is simple decay from the optical excitation to the ground state, so you can think of that as being like a T1 process. And then secondly, in the excited state is actually an orbital doublet, and there's actually a really fast, basically like bouncing between the two different excited states. And that creates decoherence of its own. I'll just talk about what sort of technological goals people are now going towards in terms of NV centers. By now, the physics of the NV center is quite well understood, although there remains open questions. But people are really pushing towards technology. In terms of quantum information, the key is always, these states have excellent spin coherence on their own, but getting them to be strongly coupled with other spins is the big challenge. There's two general approaches towards this. One is the local approach, where you have nearby NV centers strongly dipole coupled to each other, or perhaps dipole coupled to nearby nuclei, and then the nuclei dipole coupled to other NV centers. And
so they dipole couple, how you control that coupling?
How do you control it?
Yeah, that would be important if you want to do any manipulation. You need to have certain control over that coupling.
Yeah, and I
to turn it on and off.
Yeah, and I don't think anybody's been able to do that.
Is there a principal way to do that?
Control dipole coupling, this strength. You know, if they're just next to each other and dipole coupled, I don't think so. There have been, you know, some proposals for mediating the dipole coupling through other electronic states, like, and spin chains.
So yeah, but this is not good for quantum computing. It's good for memory.
The dipole coupling approach. I think if you need to turn it on and off like that, and you do, then that approach is not scalable and wouldn't work. Yeah. The other general approach, besides dipole coupling and local approaches, is a long distance approach where you have NV center spins getting entangled with photons, and then photons interfered with each other through a beam splitter, and then through a heralded process that entangles the spins with each other. This has been shown with two NV centers recently in two different cryostats at Delft. A lot of the sensing goals are a lot more near term. People are putting nanodiamonds inside of cells, like HeLa cells shown here, to sense magnetic fields in the cells, magnetotactic bacteria, temperatures of cells, and so forth. And then another big application is if you can have NV centers that are very close to a surface, then you can actually sense the nuclear field of chemicals that are adsorbed on the surface. So there's an effort to scale down nuclear magnetic resonance to the nanometer scale. And the state of the art now is basically a 5 nanometers cubed volume.
How precise and how you determine the distance from the NV center to the surface?
Yes, that's actually not easy at all, it turns out. The best thing that people have done is actually bring an NV center that's on a scanning tip down near the surface, and then by looking at the strength of the dipole interaction, you can get the distance.
Can you bring a controlled magnetic object to calibrate this magnetic shift?
Yep. I think the way people have done it is actually they have the magnetic object on the substrate, and then you bring a tip close with an NV center. But I think either way it would work. So anyway, yeah, the key here to getting this to work better is to have better quality NV centers near surfaces. And that turns out to not be easy at all, in part because there's a lot of just sort of junk on the surface, which causes decoherence. All right. Okay, so there's big challenges to NV centers in diamond. Among them are creating high quality spins near surfaces, creating high quality spins in nanodiamonds, for coupling spins to light. A big problem is this phonon sideband. So this is the emission spectrum shown here. And there's a zero phonon line, both at low temperature and high temperature. It gets enhanced at low temperature. But as you can see, it's relatively small compared to the total emission spectrum. So about 97% of photons, even at extremely low temperatures, go into the phonon sideband. This is not ideal if you want NV center spin to be coupled to a photon and have identical photons coming out of it. Now, the natural solution to this would actually be a deal breaker for a lot of the quantum information applications, except for the fact that there's a hope of putting NV centers in photonic crystals, narrowing the optical emission. And people have been working on that and making some progress, but their efforts have been limited by the fact that, you know, there's really very limited diamond processing technology. You know, there's no such thing as diamond epitaxial films. For making a two-dimensional photonic crystal, you actually have to take a bulk diamond and mechanically thin it down to like 200 nanometers. It's not really scalable. It hasn't worked that well yet. A number of researchers all over the world are trying to address these challenges. And our approach in the Avshalom group, instead of trying to improve diamond, it's been to find this sort of NV center physics in other systems. And we've had a lot of success very recently with silicon carbide. So why silicon carbide? Well, it's on some superficial levels, it's very similar to diamond. In fact, you can by silicon carbide jewels that are fake diamonds, essentially, because they have the same index of a fraction of as diamond, and they look like diamonds to the eye. It's called moissanite in the jewelry industry, named after Henri Moissan, who found silicon carbide in a meteor in the 1800s. And so silicon carbide is actually very rare naturally on Earth, but it turns out to be very readily grown. There's a huge number of growth processes for it. 6-inch wafers are available on the market. You can buy one right now. It's heavily used for power electronics. There's doping, epitaxial films of silicon carbide and epitaxial films of a number of materials on top of silicon carbide, both things that don't really happen in diamond. It's a great material for micromechanics. And in fact, actually, the first LEDs were made in 1907 out of silicon carbide. And we've identified the dye vacancy in silicon carbide as being very analogous to NV centers in many ways. So dye vacancy is a missing carbon atom next to a missing silicon atom. Just like NV centers in diamond, they exhibit optical spin polarization and readout through fluorescence, microwave spin control, long spin coherence times that persist up to room temperature. And if you look at their structure in a little more detail, you'll see it's not a coincidence. Both defects are comprised of 6 electron states. So in NV centers in diamond, there's 3 electrons coming from the dangling bonds next that would attach to the carbon that's missing, then 2 from the nitrogen, and then 1 more from the lattice because it's a negatively charged state. And then for silicon carbide dye vacancy, you have 6 electrons, 3 dangling bonds surrounding each vacancy.
So 2 silicon atoms, that's what?
I'm sorry, 1 carbon, 1 missing carbon atom next to 1 missing silicon atom. Here's a, maybe this will help a little bit. This is, silicon carbide is built from so-called basal planes. So you can see there, here they are in a hexagonal lattice. Both NV center and diamond and silicon carbide dye vacancy have the same symmetry, which is called C3V. So that C3V symmetry essentially means that there's threefold rotational symmetry of the defect and then also 3 mirror planes. And then, you know, the defect states are built from the dangling bond states, just like with an atom or molecule.
The feature on the left of the screen, what is so the empty sphere presumably missing silicon atom?
Okay, so this is diamond, and so this is a missing carbon atom, and then this is a nitrogen atom, and then this.
So let's imagine this is silicon carbide.
Yeah. What's that?
So
it would have this silicon carbide does come in the same structure as diamond.
Right.
So you could have the same structure in silicon carbide too.
So why don't you show it on the same kind of graph? The picture you have in the middle looks different.
Well, it's a different defect that we've looked at. We're not looking at nitrogen vacancies in silicon carbide. We're looking at dye vacancy.
So can you show it on the picture on the left?
Could I show a dye vacancy on the left? Yes, but they don't have the same properties. So
no answer yet.
Yeah.
So this thing which you were talking about in the last couple of minutes, what will it look like in the picture on the left of the screen? I presume there will be still an empty carbon atom, right? An empty there will be a missing carbon atom. Is this correct or not?
I guess I don't understand the question. What would the dye vacancy look like in diamond?
No, okay.
I'm sorry. Yeah.
Actually, what kind of silicon carbide you work with?
We've worked with all 3 of the most common polytypes, 4H, 6H, and 3C. So this right here is a little unit cell of 4H. So anyway.
So that's different.
The silicon carbide comes in different crystal structures, yeah, and I'll talk about that in on the next slide, in fact. Just to continue here, when you basically place these 6 electrons into their orbitals, these orbitals look very similar, and that's part of the reason why they both have an S equals 1 spin triplet ground state. So these A1 levels are very analogous to S levels in an atom. that fill up here, and these E levels are analogous to P levels. So you have basically EX, EY orbitals filled, and then the two electrons align due to a Hund's rule type coupling. That's responsible for the spin one, both for dye vacancy and for envy center in diamond. Just to go to what you were saying right here, there's a lot of unique properties of silicon carbide that diamond doesn't have. We've been trying to take advantage of them too. One of them is that silicon carbide comes in actually over 200 different crystal structures called polytypes or polymorphs. So these are just different ways that you can layer the basal planes on top of each other. So the three most important in industry are 4H, 6H, and 3C. 3C is a cubic crystal, so it has the same crystal structure as diamond if you were to replace the silicon atoms with carbon atoms. The different polymorphs have, in some cases, significantly different properties, different band gaps, different applications, and distinct but related defect states.
Does it depend on the substrate you make from?
For 4H and 6H, we're using bulk wafers, and 3C, we're using epitaxial films. And as far as the epitaxial films go, it does matter because they're more strained than the bulk wafers.
Which of the forces most likely, if I make a very thin layer, let's imagine 2 nanometers. So I take one of the standard substrates, try to grow this with just, let's say, 20 layers.
Yep.
Which of these will form?
Well, I think it depends on what you're trying to grow it on top of. 3C is the only one that can be grown epitaxially on top of silicon. So I would guess 3C. But, you know, if you're growing on top of 4H, you'll probably get 4H.
Have you found out which one is best to give you the best defect centers?
So far the best we've gotten is in 4H, but that's not necessarily an intrinsic best. That's just the best we've done.
And how do you create the centers, silicon carbide?
Okay, yeah, I'll show that right here on this slide. In 4H, we actually got lucky because the manufacturer, which is Cree, which is actually a big time player in power electronics, they sell a material where they intentionally introduce vacancy complexes to pin the Fermi level. So that the material is not naturally n-type. And then we actually just happened to shine light on the material and saw that there are these defects that we were interested in. In 6H and 3C, we had to create them. So we did that by either ion bombardment using carbon atoms to just create damage in the crystal, or irradiation, which also creates vacancies. Then when you anneal the crystals, the vacancies migrate and form vacancy complexes. And we collaborated with Case Western Reserve researchers, which I believe have collaborated here at Purdue too, to get the 3C silicon carbide.
How much is that 6-inch wafer?
Ooh, I've never gotten a quote. 4-inch wafers are about $2,000. So multiply that by 6 squared over 2 squared. I don't know. Okay, so in addition to just creating defects in the bulk, we've been able to pattern the defects by using electron beam lithography, making an array of 50 nanometer holes in e-beam resist, and then bombarding ions through that holes. And then the resulting pattern you can see here. Now, these actually aren't single defects in silicon carbide. We're still in the ensemble regime, but we estimate that there's about 10 defects per spot here in this array. There's a sample that I calibrated the density precisely using double electron resonance, and then here comparing the intensity of photons to that intensity.
And what kind of setup do you use for bombardment?
I'm actually not sure how that works. For electron irradiation, we send it off to a Van der Graaff generator. For ion bombardment, you know, there's just standard semiconductor vendors that that do that. I'm not sure how that works. Okay, so when you look at these defects in photoluminescence, For 3C, there's just one peak. But for 4H and 6H, there's a number of different zero phonon line peaks. And that's because, it's a binary lattice, and there's, you know, depending on which silicon and which carbon atom is missing, there's inequivalent states, in 4H and 6H. In general, for NH silicon carbide, there's N inequivalent, states for the dye vacancy. These are labeled PL1 through PL4 and QL1 through QL6 for 4H and 6H. And actually for 4H, there's also these two peaks here, PL5 and 6. And we don't know what they are, nor does anyone else, but they have really interesting properties, so I'll be coming back to them later.
What was going to happen if you increase the temperature? What I don't understand is that 6 Kelvin peak just seems to have a much broader peak.
Yes, it's broadened at low temperature because the 3C is actually an epitaxial film, unlike the others, which are bulk. So there's a lot more strain, and strain essentially broadens the ZPL.
All right, so let's imagine we take the spectrum at 400 Kelvin instead of 20 Kelvin. How would it look like any one of those?
Yeah. Yes, right. it depends on the defects for reasons we don't fully understand. Most of these broaden and become less pronounced by about 200 Kelvin. PL5 and 6 actually stay quite sharp even at room temperature.
So you're saying that room temperature properties actually, in that sense...
are very different. Yes, that's right. And it depends on the defect form, too. And that's something we don't understand at the moment. We've just observed it. But one particularly interesting thing, comparing these ZPLs to diamond envy centers, you can see they're more in the near IR, approaching the telecom wavelength, which is important for a number of applications, including photonics.
But can it be the telecom wavelengths?
Well, the sideband can reach up to telecom. These defects themselves are higher energy.
That sideband at the room temperature?
It's still there. Yeah. Yeah. Okay. So that's just the optical properties. Coming to the spin properties. So to measure the spin, we just fix a near infrared laser on the defects and then simultaneously apply a microwave field, sweep the frequency of that microwave field and look for resonances, which is changes in the amount of fluorescence, either greater or less than. And you can see a number of resonances here, which I've labeled. Then if you also make a two-dimensional image, where we're sweeping the magnetic field along with the resonance, you can see these, defect states evolving according to, the Zeeman effect. And so each form of defect has two spin transitions going from M sub s equals minus 1 to 0 and then 0 to plus 1. And so essentially each pair of ODMR resonances correlates with one zero phonon line, and we correlated that. And one especially interesting property of these defects, which we were actually surprised to find, is their intrinsic ODMR contrast is surprisingly high. It's 15% to 35%, in some cases even exceeding the contrast for the envy center in diamond. So you can imagine if you want to read out the spin, you want a really high value of this quantity so that you have a big change in fluorescence when the defect is spin up versus spin down.
Same question as before. Yeah. I
will show that right here. Okay. So first of all, I'll come to that in just 1 second. This here was 6H silicon carbide. We can have a similar picture in 4H, 6H, and 3C silicon carbide. And you can see there's similar but different spin transitions. In some sense, you can view tuning the crystal structure as a way of tuning the spin properties of the defects. Now, when we warm up to room temperature, we do see ODMR resonances. However, some of these lines have lost their ODMR resonance and have lost their visibility, and some have not. In particular, PL5 and 6 actually are the strongest at room temperature. There's been some interesting theoretical studies for envy centers in diamond, which basically explain why you lose the visibility of the spin as the temperature is warmed up. And although we don't understand silicon carbide well enough to have a complete picture, you know, that's something that we're aiming towards, certainly. But here, especially for certain defect forms, there's very strong room temperature spin addressability. Okay, so these are all continuous wave measurements. We've also done pulsed measurements. So here's essentially standard Hahn echo sequences to look at the spin coherence T2 times. And we see very long T2 times. At low temperature, you know, if you just look at here, this curve here in the x-axis, you can see it, the T2 time extends up to about 360 microseconds. At room temperature, we've been able to see Hahn echo data for both PL5 and 6 shown here, and also certain forms of the dye vacancy with about 50 microsecond spin coherence times at room temperature. So as I was saying earlier, this T2 time being long is really important for applications. We're really happy to see long spin coherence times here. So in this sense, these defects are very analogous to NV centers in Diamond.
Have you looked at the photon statistics? G2 measurement?
So we haven't isolated single defects yet. So if we just did it on an ensemble, we probably wouldn't see anything. We're heavily working towards getting towards single defects right now. And actually by getting a more purified material from collaborators in Sweden.
So nobody looked at so far at single defects?
People have looked at single defects in silicon carbide, but not paired magnetic ones. So it will be possible, but no one has done that yet.
So it's somewhat a challenge to do, because that's really needed here.
That's right. Yep. Well, it's certainly possible. The challenge is just that, you know, getting the material that's purified enough to see it. And there is basically commercial material is not, but material that collaborators can grow for this very purpose is. I mean, just looking...
That was your biggest motivation. That's commercially available product, right? So it's good. It's used by power electronics. But you don't have this single vacancy.
Yeah, well, I think for, you know, for using the commercial material, it would probably have to be ensemble studies unless it becomes more purified. Mm-hmm. I mean, nowadays, there's a lot of commercial growers that will grow epitaxial films of anything you want. So I see that as being possible, but not at the moment.
And what is a typical fluorescence lifetime?
It's about 14 nanoseconds. So very comparable. Yep. Okay. So just moving on to some applications, controlling electron spins with electric fields and strain. And one of the motivations here is to be able to manipulate an isolated spin in a dense array. So localizing spin control. So to look at both the effect of electric fields and strain on silicon carbide defects, we thin silicon carbide down to 50 micron membranes and then put them either between electrodes or mounted them on piezos in order to strain the crystal uniaxially. Then we essentially, apply a perturbation, see that perturbation causes a phase accumulation during a Hahn echo sequence, which is just to say that the perturbation is shifting the spin transition energies. And we found that silicon carbide has about 2 to 7 times stronger electric field response than NV centers in diamond. And also that they're very sensitive to strain, about 10 to the minus 7 strain per root hertz per spin. So because measuring strain using a spin is an intrinsic technique, it doesn't rely on, total displacement. It has a good outlook for probing strain in nanostructures in particular, and coupling to nanomechanical resonators. So those are the spin transitions. Looking at the optical transitions, we find them to either bifurcate or trifurcate depending on the defect orientation. So the basal-oriented defect ZPLs trifurcate because there's three equivalent defects which become inequivalent with uniaxial strain applied. And then the basal-oriented defects bifurcate. Essentially, this is the two EX and EY orbitals getting different energies. They have orthogonal polarization. So this is a verification that silicon carbide neutral divacancies have C3V level structure, like in diamond. We've also collaborated with a theorist, Adam Galli, in Hungary to understand these defects on a better level. He's a density functional specialist, so he's been modeling these defects. He very precisely replicated the crystal field parameters that we measured, and also explained the enhanced Stark effect that we found in terms of the polarizability of the electrons and the defects.
What's the D parameter?
The D parameter is the crystal field splitting between M sub s equals 0 and M sub s equals plus 1 and minus 1 in the ground state.
So that's not a function of the crystal group, that is a strong function. Difference between diamond and the silicon carbide. Why is it?
Why is there a different D parameter for?
Yeah, between the silicon carbide and diamond.
You know, that's a good question. It's derived primarily from the spin-spin interactions, and so it's basically just the overlap of the electron orbitals is different in silicon carbide. It's not as strong as in diamond. That's probably due to the fact, now that I think about it, actually, that in diamond the confinement is stronger, so the electron orbitals are more on top of each other. Yeah.
And you say there's a strong Stark effect. Is this a linear or quadratic Stark effect?
It's linear.
And what's the dipole moment? How large is it?
I believe it is 35 hertz per volt per centimeter. That's probably not units that make sense, but that's what we measure. I don't know how to convert that off the top of my head.
So you don't know if it's in atomic units or divide?
No. Okay, but one thing we've been trying to use the stronger Stark effect for is to resonantly drive spin transitions. So instead of using DC electric field, use AC electric field. We can get pretty fast Rabi oscillations just using AC electric fields. And then actually, at the same time, image the AC electric field coming from this patterned electrode array that we saw here. And the motivation here is to the fact that electric fields are more confinable than magnetic fields. So you can imagine an array of electric fields that are, rotating spins on a nanometer scale, unlike magnetic fields. This was on the cover of PRL just a few weeks ago. It's kind of a silly image, but you get the idea. Many spins in an array.
Please go back to the previous slide.
Yes.
The pattern in the left part of the slide.
Yes.
Why does it have this shape? Why is the period chosen to be a quarter ton microns?
Okay, the period could be anything. It was sort of randomly chosen. The reason why we did this shape was so that we could just initially use a lens and collect photoluminescence from all of this at once just for an initial study. Then when we actually, imaged it using a microscope objective, it became essentially an arbitrary pattern. Okay, and one final interesting note for it. Silicon carbide, because there's these inequivalent forms, it's possible to observe very readily interactions between the inequivalent forms. So essentially, even in an ensemble sense, what's the magnetic field exerted on one spin species by another spin species? And the way to measure this is called double electron resonance, where we essentially identify one spin species as a drive species, one species as a sense species, periodically flip the magnetic field of the drive spin species, and observe the change in precession rate of the sense spin species. This data is shown here on the right. So there's Rabi oscillations in the black, and the blue is the sense species sensing that magnetic field. And by looking at both coherent and incoherent interactions, we could separately infer the spin density of the sample and the degree of optical spin polarization, which turned out to be quite high. And the motivation here is that this approach could be extended to couple many individual but inequivalent closely spaced defects in a dense array. Okay, and moving on to outlook. I'll wrap up pretty fast here. Coupling spins to photonic crystals and photonic structures is one of the most important steps forward for this field in general. And in so that you can have indistinguishable photons coming from different centers so that they can be interfered together. This has not worked very well in diamond. In silicon carbide, there's a number of opportunities. 3C silicon carbide can be grown as an epitaxial film. Because the wavelength range is more into the infrared, conventional silicon photonic crystal cavities could actually be used as the resonator for capturing the emission from silicon carbide. And this could be a really powerful strategy because those resonators are really strong. In terms of a broadband strategies for just altering the emission rate, there's been work here at Purdue that showed that metamaterials could really drastically enhance the emission rate from centers. Silicon carbide is also a great material for micromechanics. So, I mean, there's a general motivation here of having defects strongly coupled to mechanical resonators strongly coupled to each other, and thereby having spins be coupled strongly to each other through micromechanics. In addition to photonic mechanical interfaces, there's a lot of electronic interfaces. Yeah.
If you entangle two spin qubits, is there a way to do that?
Yes. So optically, it's done by you have two spins that are entangled with photons separately, and then the photons are interfered through a beam splitter, so that there's a heralded process which interferes the spins. Then.
So that part works similarly as you would do for diamond
as well. That's right. Yeah. I mean, and I think, you know, in the long term, everything would be done on chip too. There's a number of very interesting electronic interfaces. I mean, for one thing, you could just put silicon carbide defects in off-the-shelf high-speed transistors and high-performance electronic devices. One area that I'm particularly interested in is developing microscope-free platforms for exciting and measuring defects. In particular, electroluminescence from diamond envy centers has never been able to been shown. Essentially, the doping level is not engineerable enough. And when you get a big enough voltage to excite envy centers, you change the envy centers to their wrong charge state, and they're not paramagnetic. But in silicon carbide, this isn't necessarily true. So that's on the excitation end. And that would help these centers go into a lot of environments where you, say, can't have a high-power laser like a cell. One thing that I'm very interested in is coupling spin states to nanostructures, both incorporating them into nanostructures, taking advantage of the fact that there's a lot of nanostructures that are very high quality once you start going beyond diamond, including nanotubes for chemical sensing. And I'm also interested in sensing the magnetic field of nanostructures, like single molecule magnets, by using the spins as fluorescent labels. What's that? These were on the several microns range.
And that's straight.
Fairly straight, yeah. Okay, so sensing. There's quite a number of very interesting systems to look at beyond diamond and silicon carbide. This is a theoretical study that, you know, evaluated certain materials and found a number of good candidates, in particular, like zinc oxide. For hosting paramagnetic spin states.
Can you say a few more words about zinc oxide because we're interested in this material?
Zinc oxide has relatively low spin orbit coupling, which makes it good for this type of physics, just looking at the difference between the bands. And I believe there have been a number of defects that have shown optically detected magnetic resonance in zinc oxide. And in fact, I believe the nitrogen vacancy center is one of them. But it has not been looked at very extensively. And I want to mention finally that, you know, even though so far the optically detected magnetic resonance that I've shown is just based on fluorescence intensity, it's really simple. There's techniques borrowing from atomic physics like coherent population trapping, which can read out defect spins and allow defects to be addressed without having this intersystem crossing. And so it basically can bring in, you know, other defects into this sort of physics, single spin physics. Okay, and I will conclude here. I want to thank my collaborators at UCSB in Chicago, and Case Western Reserve in Hungary and Iowa, say that I showed that coherent control of optically addressable defects in wide gap semiconductors are very powerful for prospective technologies. Right now, they're all prospective. Moving to new materials. And commercially viable materials is the best choice, in my opinion, for turning these prospective technologies into ones that are actually used. Developing new techniques for spin control along with a new understanding of these defects is really the most important route forward. So thank you very much.